Well, good morning. Really great to meet so many known faces from all these different backgrounds. I think some of you I know because I worked for the Franciscans for many years. It was a very faithful and difficult job. And so I guess I would maybe also say, besides following a Buddhist practice, I'm a somewhat wounded Catholic. So trying to, you know, it's like, how does the Kabbalah says all the religions are branches on the same tree? And also, you know, what I'm presenting today is probably my, maybe as an informed consent, it's not so much a religion, it's a practice. And I think many people combine, you know, a Buddhist-inspired practice with this Judaism, this Christianity, with actually some Muslims who practice Buddhist practices. So it's not presenting a new religion. I just wanted to, in case you expected that, that's not what it is. But I will present quite a bit of Buddhist philosophy and psychology, because very much, you know, you might know the Buddha really started with his first noble truth with, well, life, so much of life is suffering. For sure it's impermanent, and what can we do about it? So that was really his big question. And that really brings us to compassion. So I will today present what I've found in Buddhist psychology written about compassion, and just introducing you a little bit to, you know, the fundamentals of that and how to expand compassion from ourselves to others to the world. And then I will talk a little bit about what I call wounded bodhicitta. What holds us back? You know, what holds us back to actually be able to practice compassion? And how can we bring the universal and the personal or the conventional together? And if there's enough time, I have until 11, is that right? And then I come back? Until when? Oh, cool. But at 12, 5 after 12, I have to be in my office. That will be okay, right? Good. Yeah, so I have, how much of the time will be questions and answers? Half hour. But so this is great, because then we do have time to meditate a little bit together, which will be wonderful. That will be great. And I will also present what I might call a case example. You know, the example of a person and what they present, which is very mundane, you might say, very everyday life, and how I would work with that, or how one would work with that within Buddhist psychology and philosophy. And then it would be just really lovely if we have time to meditate together. And then I really look forward to your questions and answers. And please be irreverent. What do you think? Good. Very good. I like that. So I wanted to start today's talk with a myth. And I think it was James Hillman who said, myth is something that never happened and always is. Myth is something that never happened and always is. So this is the myth of Asanga. And I wanted to say the notes I'm using are from my book To Be, which is almost at its first draft. So I'm not reading anybody else. I'm just using myself as a cliff notes. Okay, so the myth of Asanga. In the first century, there was a famous Indian named Asanga, who was a great teacher. He was one of the scholars who were interpreting the Nagarjuna stanzas, the Madhmaraka Karakas, which were explaining the meaning of the perfection of wisdom. So, Asanga wanted to have direct contact with Maitreya, the Buddha-to-be, in order to gain his wisdom. With this pursuit, he spent many years in retreat, like many Buddhist yogis do. They go up into a cave and gone they are for a long time. When he finally came out of his sanctuary, he was disappointed because he did not have this direct communication with Maitreya. So he thought he had failed and spent so many years in vain. And as he walked down out of his cave, he saw on the path a dog that was lying there dying. The dog was bleeding, his guts were coming out, and it was a pathetic sight. Asanga knelt down beside the dog and saw there were maggots crawling and eating the flesh. He felt such compassion for the dog that while kneeling there, he tried to remove the maggots. However, he realized he could not do this with his fingers because it might hurt his dog. So Asanga lay down beside the dog and removed the maggots with his tongue. Sorry, it will be a while before the break. And as he was doing that, the dog turned into Maitreya, his beloved master. Asanga was so joyful that he picked Maitreya up and put him on his shoulders and walked into the village. All the people in the village thought he had gone crazy because he was carrying this horrible, emaciated, dead dog on his shoulders. But for Asanga, this was Maitreya. So, in this story, Asanga's profound compassion was stronger than his asceticism and even his desire for bliss. And it was his great care and tenderness that ultimately awakened him. So I thought that's a very important story because I think it speaks also about some of the early misconceptions that were there about Buddhist practice, that it's mainly about finding one's individual bliss and being detached and removed. The Buddha himself spent years of his life with ascetic practices in the forest, striving to control his body and mind. In some ways, one could say that Siddhartha, the ascetic in the forest who would later become the Buddha, might have been somewhat self-involved and self-preoccupied with this pursuit. Yet, when he finally sat down under the Bodhi tree and contemplated how suffering for all beings could be relieved, how we all could find freedom, how all life is interconnected and everything is constantly co-rising with each other, and that is why we should care, that's when he became enlightened. So Asanga's story is about how we see, how we perceive the world around us. To live a compassionate life also means to recognize suffering and to allow oneself to be deeply, deeply moved by the dog's misery. So often we have become calloused and numbed against the perception of distress and anguish in others. Often this is perceived as an adaptive coping mechanism, assisting us in pushing through the demands of life. However, imagine if we lived in the world where everybody's heart was porous enough to sense another's pain and act on the impulse to help. Then we would see Maitreya. So now I wanted to talk a little bit about compassion in the Buddhist tradition. But before that, I want to bring a quote by Carl Safina, who actually is not a Buddhist. My husband, Michael Carney, is very much into ecology and environmental, you know, and global warming and love for the world, the environment. And Carl Safina says, "The geometry of human progress is a widening circle of compassion. The geometry of human progress is a widening circle of compassion." So when we think of compassionate role models, we might say, whom should we picture as a compassionate person? Is it Mother Teresa, who tirelessly sacrifices herself for the dying in Calcutta? Is it the monk who is in a cave yet has the care for the world in his heart? Is it the mother who cares for her children and all their friends who are in need and basically self-sacrifices herself and gets exhausted to a point where she gets utterly run down and sick herself? Or is it the lady in the suburbs who takes care of her nuclear family and maybe a few around, but whose compassion stops when people are different from her in race or gender orientation? Or is it the activist who dedicates himself to the sorrows of the world, yet at the same time forgets about his wife and children? And, you know, I don't have the answer. It's up to you to find the answer. But I'm just putting out questions. So I wanted to bring the views of some of the great thinkers, Buddhist thinkers of today, and what they say about compassion, and just present that to you. Jack Kornfield, who's my mentor and a meditation teacher and a wonderful writer, describes compassion as the quivering of our hearts when feeling another's sorrow. The quivering of our hearts when feeling another's sorrow. He speaks here about a deep feeling response, a movement of the heart when witnessing the moment of another's anguish. His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, whom I was so lucky to be with him and his teachings for 3 days in early July, which is always like such a treat. There's just such an amazing energy there. And I guess one of the things that really struck me sitting, he has his teachings in the temple. So there are a few, maybe 2,000 people, lots of Tibetan villagers, many monks, and then lots of Indians come, and people, monks and lay people from all around the world. So you see Thai monks and Vietnamese monks and Zen monks and Sri Lankan monks and a few Christian nuns, and you see all kinds of folks there. And it's just such a, it is such a inspiration, you know, to see people there. They are not thinking about their differences, it seems. He has this kind of vibe, you might say, that makes people forget about their differences, which I just find so inspiring. You know, I just wish we had a Dalai Lama here in Santa Barbara. All the Christians and Jews and Buddhists, they would all sit together. So the Dalai Lama says, compassion and love can be defined as the positive thoughts and feelings that give rise to such essential things in life as hope, courage, determination, and inner strength. Compassion is the wish for another being to be free from suffering. Love is wanting others to be happy. So if I unpack a little bit this quote of the Dalai Lama, I would say he sees love and compassion as the origin of, as the origin for what is positive and life-giving in us. We all have Buddha nature or Christ nature, or as Matthew Fox says, original blessing, meaning the seeds for an innate goodness within us. His Holiness sees those kernels, those seeds, which can be cultivated by practice as what gives us the strength to do the right thing. The chutzpah, which is a Yiddish word, to be an actively positive force in our world. The Dalai Lama regards love and compassion as the two sides of the same coin. Love emphasizing the well-wishing and wanting others to be glad. Compassion, the wish to help others to overcome their sorrow and misery. Compassion, according to His Holiness, is also the sensitivity, the feeling response, the experience when we encounter another's misery. So when I was up in Dharamsala, I think it was last year, I had these long talks with His Holiness's translator, Mr. Tsepak. And Mr. Tsepak was at some point a monk, is now a layman, and is his translator who basically travels with him in India. And also, he told me this time he was very exhausted. He had been in 3 months and 5 continents. And the interesting thing was, he says, I'm so exhausted. He was really exhausted. And so I said, how is His Holiness the Dalai Lama? He says, oh, he's fine. He has so much energy. He gets up every morning at 3 and does his bodhicitta practice. But everybody around him seems really... So it was an interesting story. So he mentioned this word popa, P-O-P-B-A, which is a not very well-known Tibetan word. And I checked it out with Jose Cabezan, who's the chair of the Religious Studies Department at UCSB, or I think now it's Karen Moore, but they just switched. And he teaches Tibetan Buddhism, so he gave me some information about this too. So popa can be understood as courage, the strength, the gutsiness, which comes straight out of our hearts with the wish to assist another who is in distress. The positive action we extend in response to witnessing another's misery comes back to us as self-esteem. So it's kind of a feedback loop. So we feel stronger as we act on the grounds of this popa. But it is important that popa does not come from guilt, obligation, pressure from above, but that popa comes from an authentic feeling and a free and upbeat wish to help others, which I find very important, because in my upbringing, I went to 9 years of Catholic nun boarding school, which had many wonderful aspects to it. But I do remember that at times, Mitgefühl was it then in German, feeling with others was seen as service, kind of like a self-sacrificing service. And kind of, you know, if you want to go to heaven instead of hell, kind of thing. And so So I really found this idea of Popa very refreshing. You know, that you have to find this place in your heart that comes out of a sense of upbeatness or gutsiness or joy, and then it actually feeds you. And I'm saying that I often feel that when I do twice a week meditation groups, one at my office and one at La Casa de Maria, and often, you know, I start every morning at 8 and the meditation groups are at 6. And sometimes I'm quite, you know, I'm getting a little tired in the afternoon. But I love the meditation groups. And people say, and sometimes I think, well, now meditation group, you know, couldn't I just go home, put my feet up? And people say, it's a lot. But I feel better afterwards. You know, it feels like I recharged my battery and I'm ready to face my kids and my husband and all of that. Probably more as if I didn't do the meditation group. So, which is interesting, and I kind of wonder if it's a little bit of popa because I like it so much. So, I wanted to talk a bit about compassion as deep feeling quality. So I'll talk about the different aspects of compassion. So meditation teacher Joseph Goldstein, he was one of the first ones who brought Buddhist practice back from Thailand, I think in the 70s. He proposes compassion is the strong feeling to want to alleviate another's suffering. The Buddha called this tenderness of the heart. When we have an ongoing practice, slowly a softening of the mind and the heart takes place, which then transforms how we relate to others and ourselves. So he introduces the understanding that we have a choice to develop this quality of our heart. And you know, there's always a little grace in it, but I think choice and practice is very important. A regular practice of meditation and of developing an attitude of being mindful, kind, caring, generous, and grateful is a certain way to develop a present and tender heart. So, for me as a psychologist, that's really quite interesting because modern neurophysiology says that we actually need to practice quite continuously to slowly change this neural pathways, especially when they're entangled due to trauma or to whatever there is. And that very much comes together. So I think that's why the big universities like UCLA or Stanford with their compassion project, they latched on to Buddhist practice because it fits with modern neurophysiology. You know, it takes a lot of practice, practicing a new habit, you might say, if you want it to be cognitive behavioral. So I just find it interesting how all of this, you know, the spiritual and the and science are now coming together. So how wonderful that there can be hope for change in the course of our life. There is room for a whole new way of being to develop. And His Holiness the Karmapa, who is the second highest spiritual leader in the Tibetan, however you call it, Olympus. A young man with surprising wisdom and popa, as I might say. And he says, when you are dreaming of what is possible for your life, you should know that anything is possible. You may not always feel or see it, but you never for a single moment lack the capacity to change course. Your life is subject to infinite revision. Not only do you have this infinite freedom to shape yourself all the time, but what you do also helps shape the world around you. And I think the Dalai Lama's writing a lot about this, like ethics for a new millennium or beyond religion. You know, he really speaks to that. Especially this quality of our hearts can undergo transformation, particularly with ongoing practice. A hardened, aloof, or numb heart can turn into one being tender and responsive to others. If the person has the longing, intention, and motivation to change, how longer it may take. And it's quite interesting that at least in Buddhist psychology, intention or motivation is more important than what you did. So there's this interesting story. I have in my book here so many stories, and I'm not presenting them today, but there is one I wanted to present, which is one that Jack Kornfield often talks about, and that's about Jarvis J. Masters, who is a death row inmate at San Quentin. And Jarvis came from this desperately poor, ill-fated African-American family, bouncing most of his childhood around from foster care to foster care, until finally at 12, he became a ward of the court due to delinquency. And as an angry young man of 17, he was released to the California Youth Authority, and he continued on crime sprees and holding up stores and restaurants and murdering quite a few people. And he ended up on death row in 1981. However, during several decades of meditation, I guess it's now three decades, he slowly changed. And he wrote two very moving books, Finding Freedom and That Bird Has My Wings, which give hope and inspiration to many others for whom life took a bad turn. Actually, That Bird Has My Wings, there's a story that Jarvis one day sat in the courtyard of, you know, I guess they can look out actually on the ocean, but through fences, and with another inmate. And this bird, I think it was a seagull, was sitting there. And the guy beside him, this big, you know, they're all very buff, guy took a stone to kind of hit the bird. And Jarvis put his hand down, and everybody kind of froze, because I guess in prison, if you do this, you know, this usually leads to violence. You know, you can't just take another prisoner's hand down. And everybody was afraid this would be now a huge, you know, outbreak of violence. Jarvis would get beaten up badly. And Jarvis just looked at the guy and he said, "That bird has my wings." And so there was no violence. So that became like the story of this book. So here Goldstein explains, understanding the difference between opening to suffering and feeling aversion to it can make the difference between living in compassion and living with fear. He further adds that compassion never comes from turning away from suffering. The strong, compassionate feeling to alleviate suffering comes from the willingness to be with it. And I think the people who also really talk a lot about this are Pema Chodron. She's a wonderful Tibetan Buddhist nun, Western Tibetan Buddhist nun, who writes about living with uncertainty, and she's just wonderful. And Joanna Macy, who's one of my personal friends, who really talks a lot about how we need to expand our compassion to the world and the animals and the land and so on. So opening to suffering can seem counterintuitive to most of what we have learned. Because most of the times we learned that we have to protect our vulnerabilities. And now we need to relearn that we become actually stronger when we learn to lean into pain rather than to avoid it. When we run away from feeling the feeling of pain, we often become more afraid of life, and we forfeit the chance to learn from and get stronger to facing and feeling our challenges. When we are truly able to face our sorrow with tranquility and tender understanding for ourselves, when we are capable to forgive the lost and naughty child within, then paradoxically we can become stronger, more self-confident, less scared, and altogether happier. Then we will be more likely capable to share our good fortune with others. So Goldstein continues, compassion arises when we come close to suffering, when we feel open to or feel the suffering either in ourselves or others. Our daily routines and distractions often dull the immediacy of difficult or painful feelings. Silence creates space for non-distraction so we can actually feel. And I have to say, I'm a big fan, you might say, of silent retreats. So since my stay in this monastery in Sri Lanka in 81, I tried to go once a year or twice a year to 10-day retreats, or as my kids get older, now and then I can do a 4-week retreat or 2-week retreat. And it's very interesting because it's kind of a sensitizing exercise. You know, as there's less and less distraction, I know, I feel more what is going on, which often isn't just pleasant. You know, I remember going through a time where I would feel all my grudges I was holding. You know, it's like, usually I think of myself as a nice person, but when I'm on retreat, there, those big grudges come up. And it's not easy to face that. And I just remember lying there day after day with my hand holding my heart and just kind of being with it. And then, you know, one of the pieces of Buddhist philosophy is that everything changes. So even suffering changes. You know, usually we see it as bad. Everything changes. My car will break down. But it's also really that, you know, our depression will pass. Our anxiety will pass when we are just with it. So change, actually, I find it also good news. So next, I wanted to talk about understanding compassion as ever-widening circles. And I have been really inspired by that by one of my teachers. Actually, I see her next week for dinner. I'm so happy. It's Joanna Macy. She's a Buddhist scholar and social activist. She's now 84, and she just comes back from a whole 3 months of teaching in Europe. It's like, geez, I don't know how she does it. Every year she says, I'm not going to travel overseas anymore, and then her calendar's full with Europe and this and that, and she does it. So, one can envision compassion as expanding in 3 concentric circles, for self, for others, and for the world. We start with compassion for self and learn to tolerate, to see ourselves without aversion or disgust, but instead with warmth and understanding. Or maybe at first we have to have warmth for our aversion and disgust. You know, sometimes we have to start there. Because the thing is, as we start to see ourselves clearly, we see also the things we don't want to see in ourselves. And then, after this, we extend compassion to others in pain, even when they are not our near, dear, and loved ones, and maybe even towards those we feel too indifferent towards, or even those we don't like or respect. And that, again, doesn't mean we have to condone their wrongdoing, you know, or we have to buddy up with them or bring ourselves into danger. But still there can be a sense of compassion and maybe even forgiveness. The third circle encompasses compassion for the world, including to communities of people who experience hardship. There are lots of those right now in the world, as well as animals, nature, and the earth. And, you know, we are coming for the first time in history to this place where the safety of the earth is in danger. We spread compassion even to those who come after us and who will inhabit this world in the future long after we are gone. And Joanna is very strong and of that. And I was wondering, how many of you have grandchildren? Oh, lots of, yeah. And so imagine your grandchildren and your grandchildren's children. Joanna always inspires us to think 7 generations ahead. What will be this world like 7 generations ahead? So this view of compassion as concentric circles to self, others, and the world is grounded in the understanding of all of us being interdependent. And I remember there was this gentleman here who loves Thich Nhat Hanh. Yeah, you. He calls it interbeing. And he writes wonderfully about this. And this understanding of interdependence can lead us to a felt sense of deep connection. When we witness another's pain, we could turn numb or we can be moved to act. The key is to experience our interconnectedness as well as understanding it intellectually. When this felt sense, or this felt and sense experience of pain meets with our insight into interconnectedness of life, then we find compassion as becoming patterned in to our way of being. So then it can become default position. You know, often we start out with feeling compassion first to somebody we like or who's close or our dog. And then it slowly becomes kind of patterned in into who we are, and then it becomes almost like the fallback reflex response. Now and then we meet people like that. It's pretty rare, but it's an amazing thing to encounter. And again, this pattern into our fabric of our personality would go along with neuroplasticity. You know, it becomes kind of part of our neural pathway. So in Buddhist philosophy, bodhicitta, there is this word bodhicitta. I wanted to explain those two words, bodhicitta and bodhisattva. You probably heard of those. So bodhicitta is our wish to help others find freedom from suffering. And bodhisattva is the one who puts this wish to help and to relieve suffering of others before his own gratification and comfort. And Pema Chodron calls bodhicitta the tender heart. I like that. Bodhicitta as the tender heart. Buddhist scholar and social activist Joanna Macy explains the desire for the welfare of all beings becomes our foundation stone. And bodhicitta is grounded in our conscious connectedness with all life. So that is our starting point that we build on. That is what Joanna says. So she further says, in the Buddhist tradition, bodhicitta is seen as something very precious, something to treasure and protect. We can think of it as a flame in our hearts and minds that guides us and shines through our actions. And she writes about this in her book, Active Hope. She has two wonderful books, Active Hope and the work that reconnects. And actually, my husband, writer, physician, social activist, Michael Carney, adds, it begins and ends with bodhicitta, the overarching desire for the welfare and well-being of others. Bodhicitta informs and infuses everything else and prevents us from unwittingly slipping back into the ingrained default assumption of the reified self and its self-referential pull, or I might just say simply our self-centeredness or self-preoccupation. So the desire for the welfare of others is an ember in each of our hearts that can blow into a flame. Choice, especially the choice to enter suffering for the sake of others, is a beautiful, courageous, and defining human characteristic that becomes increasingly possible as we deepen bodhicitta. As we come into deep connection with the ever-changing flow of what is, we come into a sense of all as family, all as kin, all as relatives, that is oxygen to the flame of bodhicitta now burning in our hearts. So that's Michael speaking. He's writing a book, Confessions of a Reluctant Activist. So the next aspect I wanted to talk about is actually a word that came up one evening when I was talking with Joanna Macy, and that is called wounded bodhicitta. It's just a word we made up. And so what is bodhicitta? So at times it seems that we just can't do it. You know, we can't get beyond the first circle. And it seems it happens under certain conditions. One of it is some of us are hurt so badly that our capacity of bodhicitta is wounded. Then our intention to bring healing and freedom to ourselves and others is blocked. And some of us might be, so the first cause for wounded bodhicitta I might see as ignorance. So many of us don't know any better. You know, if you watch TV and read newspaper, you know, we just don't know any better. We have never heard about it. So we can't even be faulted. You know, everybody is trying to be more, appear better. What is it, the three A's? Achievement, affluence, appearance. You know, if that's all we are preoccupied with, we don't even know any better. The second one is that many of us feel too messed up. You know, I'm too wounded. I have nothing to give. You know, I experienced this and that and the other thing. How can I, you know, I barely can take care of myself. How can I give anything away? Or we feel too overwhelmed. You know, many of us are caregivers. You know, we feel we are already overspent. How can I give one more thing? Or I gave too much earlier in my life. Or, you know, we are too hardened. You know, I'm sure that's how Jarvis started at the St. Quentin Penitentiary. Too hardened to feel, too numbed out. And so it takes a powerful motivation, a potent medicine, to cure the condition of wounded bodhicitta. And I was thinking of the medicine. The first one I might call, and that was my starting point, was outrage. Outrage about my own pain and the pain of other people. And you know, I'm a post-war German, so I think in the 70s when I was in high school and we found out what we Germans did, that's when they let all the info out. 6 million Jews and many others, that was the sense of outrage. How could this happen and what can we do so that this never happens again? Or outrage about our family, what they did. You know, it's like, how can anybody do that? And then the second one, the second medicine is love. You know, love for the world. I know my husband comes very much from that. He very much loves nature. He just has this love for nature and people and the earth. Or American Indian path often comes to that. And through that, we through this love, we come to compassion. Or through practice, through our inner work. And I remember when I was in Sri Lanka in this monastery for weeks after weeks, and I never sat before. I didn't know anything about Buddhism, really. I just stumbled into it. And I didn't know what would happen if I would sit. I was kind of a German-European existentialist. I thought there was the ultimate chaos and nihilism. And, you know, so I didn't know what would happen if I would sit, you know, the eternal nothing or evil or what would be there. I didn't know. And so I was really surprised as I was sitting week after week that I would become more and more calm, actually more and more happy. And I remember sitting in front of a street of ants going from one side of the path to another, probably for 2 hours or more, and just watching them and just loving them, you know, these ants going from here to there. And so I think a deep practice of prayer, of meditation, of centering prayer can do this, can bring us to this experience with life. And it's a quantum leap, however, to move from spinning the inner circle to the outer spiral. Because when we come into the outer circle, the circle become a spiral going out and out. So, let me see. Is it time for a break? Okay, so let me stop here and then I continue with the case example and with meditation. Thank you very much for bearing with me. So, when do we start up again?